morning. Good morning. So this morning I'm going to talk about, this is working, yeah. This morning I'm going to talk about case 6 of the Blue Cliff Records. Please come on in and take a seat, or go back there if you'd rather. Yeah, sure. Very simple interchange. Blue Cliff Records from 12th century China, and this is case number 6, Yunmen. Yunmen. I've talked about this, but probably it's been 4 or 5 years since I've talked about it. So Yunmen is with his monks, and he says to his monks, I don't want to ask you about the last 15 days. I only want to ask you about the next 15 days. And none of the monks respond. And then he says, every day is a good day. So that's the interchange, okay? That's the interchange. So I'm going to take it line by line, as we do generally. I don't want to ask you about the last 15 days. Well, for those of you who know Zen practice already, you know that in Buddhism and in Zen, we're focusing on not being caught by our anxious fears about the past, by our reviewing and our wringing our hands about what we should have done, what we might have done, what we would have done, what we could have done, who did what to me, and what I did to him, that kind of, on and on and on. So that's our practice, to see that and to begin to be free of it by seeing it. So I just got back from spending 3 weeks with my grandson, who is 3 years old. And my grandson, when I saw him first, he said, two taxis, a plane, and a bus, me. And then for two weeks, he was saying, every time he saw me or somebody else, two planes, a taxi, and a bus, me. And of course, we love it. We think it's cool. We love it. They get away with it. You know, they get away with it. They're just learning to develop a narrative. They're just learning to develop a past that they can articulate, that they can explain, that they can project into the future. So we love it with them. Up to a point, although even with him, by about the third week, I was thinking, come on, you know, there's some other things to talk about, right? But we don't appreciate it with adults. We don't appreciate it. Next door to the place that we have a house, and we have a small house in the Caribbean. Next door, there's a new guy who moved in, and my wife said, geez, I don't think you want to spend time with him. And I said, why not? She said, oh, he just goes over and over the past. He just over and over and over. And we don't like that about people. We don't like that about people, although we do it internally ourselves all the time. We like people. We expect people to self-monitor and just do it inside their heads. And I've talked before about one of my favorite Dylan statements. If my thought dreams were to be seen, they'd put my mind in a guillotine. Well, that's the human situation, isn't it? That's really the human situation. And that's what one of the things that Zen addresses, that Buddhism is addressing, the human situation. And meditation is the practice of seeing that stuff and beginning to come free from it. And actually becoming free from it, through this discipline. When we have retreats here of different lengths, sometimes a half day, sometimes a day, sometimes a week. We did a week one in December, and a couple people said to me, I need to do a whole week because it's not until the sixth day. The sixth day that this chatter about all the past and who did what to whom stops. Or not stops, but abates enough so I appreciate some silence. And maybe even stops. That's our practice. That's our practice. Now this takes place in this interchange at a time in China where they use the lunar calendar, and so he is actually referring to the lunar calendar, and this is this get together of the monks is on the full moon, because historically in China and then in Japan and really sometimes in the United States, I think they do it at Clouds and Water. On the full moon, you get together, and you acknowledge your karma from the past, just like we do on Tuesdays and Saturdays here. All the karma ever created by me. Some of you have said this a lot. All the karma ever created by me, from beginningless greed, hatred, and delusion, I now fully avow, I now fully acknowledge. So they did that on the full moon, and we do that ourselves. We're acknowledging that we did all this stuff, and now we can apologize for it by acknowledging it and let go of it and be free of it. But we have to, since it comes up in the human condition over and over again, every full moon they do it, and we do it here on Tuesdays and Saturdays. I don't know why we do it on Tuesdays and Saturdays. Just started doing it that way, I guess. And of course, the moon in Buddhism, the moon is a symbol for the Buddha nature. The moon is a symbol for our own quiescent, radiant, still nature. Which the ruminating mind overlooks. Which the ruminating mind just conceals. So our practice is to tap into that nature, to tap into it and to manifest it. And at a full moon ceremony, again, on any time that there's first the acknowledgement of karma, all the karma ever created by me, I now fully avow. Then there's a move on to making a vow. So first you acknowledge, then you vow. First you acknowledge what you've done, how you've been hurtful to yourself or to others. Then you vow to move out of it and be there for yourself, be there for others, and manifest that moon. That's your vow. So they're always tied together. So first the avowing, the acknowledging, and then the sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. So the two together. And the Chinese teacher Wu Men comments on this interchange, and he says, with realization, all things are one family. Without realization, all things are separate and disconnected. Simple truth. When we still our minds and open up to this full moon that's always present, then we feel that it is one family. It's all one family. So, but Wu Men adds, without realization, all things are one family too, because they are. Doesn't matter how much time I'm spending reviewing what you did to me and what he should have done to me and how you ignored me. It's still the same interdependence where I'm just not acknowledging it because I'm stuck in my own stuff. So it seems like a contradiction, but it's not a contradiction. So that's the first line. The second line, I only want to ask you about the next 15 days. Well, okay, monks, you've gotten together with me on this full moon, and you know, I think is today the, I think yesterday was the full moon. Did you see it last night? I saw it night before last. I thought I must be almost full. So here we are on the full moon then. Okay. So we avow, we acknowledge, we hurt people, we hurt ourselves, we did things we don't feel good about. We acknowledge that. We acknowledge that. We move on to vowing that we're going to do a better job to relate to each other, to be there for each other, to be there for ourselves, to manifest that full moon. And then we make some behavioral changes. We work on making behavioral changes to do that. So, monks, you've acknowledged, you've vowed, but now I want to ask you, what are you going to do during this next 15 days? you can acknowledge your karma, you know, 30 times a day and vow 30 times a day, but what are you going to do? You can go to church, you know, you can go to Zen Center, you can be here all the time, but what are you going to do behaviorally to manifest that promise that you're making to yourself? Because a vow is a promise that you're making to members of the community, this little community and this huge community. So in the Eightfold Path, we start with, and we come back to time and time again, understanding and intention. That's acknowledging and vowing. Intention, vowing. But then we actualize that through speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, meditation. And there are generally considered to be two parts of that actualization process, two parts of that require planning and then require actual conducting ourselves. And the first part is the meditation part. And you guys have heard me talk about this before. There's referred to as the two legs of Buddha. Two legs of Buddha. So monks, here we are in the full moon. Monks, tell me, you've avowed, you've vowed. Now, what are you going to do about it? What about your meditation? Are you going to develop some kind of a meditation routine? Are you going to improve what your commitment to it? Are you going to deepen it a little bit? It doesn't matter what it is, but are you going to do that? Are you going to do that? So when I first started doing meditation, when I was young, I lived kind of a far away from a Zen center, so my vow was that I was going to sit on my own and then come to the Zen center once a week. That was a pretty good vow, but it was hard. I wasn't disciplined, and my mind was all over the place, and I had lots of other things to do, so maybe I'd sit for 5 minutes one day and 6 minutes another day, and then I'd skip a few days, and then I'd get up to the Zen center, and I feel really good. And then I'd commit for the next week. Well, I worked on that for a year, and it was maybe sloppy, but at least I kept vowing, and then I had the opportunity to live up by the Zen Center. I thought, well, if I live right across the street, I'll be able to do it. So I moved right across the street. And even then, I said I was going to do it. I did it for a couple of weeks. Then, oh, my life got so busy, you know, so many things, so many demands. But then I would have to remind myself, this is why you're here, Tim. This is why you're two blocks away. So we just always need to think, how are we going to manifest this full moon? And we can only manifest it if we have meditative time in our life. If we integrate some meditative time into our schedule and really are religious about it. So I lived in northern Minnesota for a while, and I meditated with one person up there, one friend up there, and my meditation was pretty good. But then when I came down here, again, I thought, I got it, I'm just not disciplined enough. I've got to live right next to the Zen Center. So I found out they were buying this building, and I thought, I said to my wife, let's live as close as we can. So that was many, many years ago, and we just bought our house, and we moved into our house before the Zen Center moved here, just when they made their down payment. And so it helped. Not that you should do it that way. Each of us has to find our own way. And then for the behavioral part, for the conduct part, that's the speech and the action. That's the speech and the action that comes from this practice. That's the process that comes from the vow. Comes from the vow. How are we going to speak in a way that supports the fact that we are one family, that we are one family, that we are not separate? How are we going to act in that way? And we have to come back and look at that time and time again. We have to do that as individuals, and we have to do that as a culture. He's saying this to his monks as individuals, but also as a culture. As a culture, when I first started doing Zen meditation, the Vietnam War was what was it? It was killing people, and I didn't want to get drafted. I figured out how to not get drafted. I won't go into that right now. You can ask me after about that. It was the mid-60s, and I protested against the war starting in the mid-60s. My second year of doing Zen meditation, I was also protesting against the war. And, it went on and on. Most of you are younger than me, but you're my age. You remember it went on and on. I protested in 1965, and it was going on in 1972 with Richard Milhouse. What's his name? Nixon, right? but by 72, by 73, by 1974, the culture as a whole was saying, this was not good for us to have done this. We hurt people. And the Gallup polls were showing 80%, 90% of people had regrets about, Americans had regrets about the war. Had real regrets about it. And they were avowing, we were acknowledging finally as a culture that this was what we had done was not friendly, was not helpful, that did not help the world, did not help the Vietnamese, did not help ourselves. Finally, even in the so-called red states, they acknowledged it. 1974, 1975, finally. And then we moved on to, we vowed as a culture. If you remember, we vowed as a culture, we're not going to do this again. We acknowledged and then we vowed, we're not doing this again. we're done with this kind of thing. We're gonna be there for other people and not try to force our way of life on them through arms. We're going to develop a plan. Our plan is that presidents are not going to have that much power anymore. Johnson had the power, Nixon had the power, but we're not going to do that. We're not going to allow our executive branch to control things, and the Senate and the House are going to stand up to the executive branch, because we don't want to kill these people in foreign lands anymore. Some of you remember this, right? If you don't remember, you read about it. And we did it. We were okay for what? For 20, 25 years. And then 2001, World Trade Center. And we freaked out as a culture. We were scared. greed, hatred, and delusion comes from fear. It comes from fear. Endless greed, hatred, and delusion. That's what creates our karma, and it comes from fear. So we were afraid as a culture, and we turned our authority over to you-know-who and his cronies, right? And we did it again. We did it again. No denying. No denying. So now we've avowed. Again, we've acknowledged. The Gallup polls, I looked at the Gallup polls 3 months ago. As a culture, we've acknowledged this was not a good idea. This was not a way to influence people in Iraq. Are we going to develop another plan? Our other plan, our first plan, seemed like it would have worked if we hadn't freaked out. We freak out. My zazen is so good for a while. Your zazen is so good for a while, and then something comes up, and you go back into your instinctual fear right away. It just happens, and then you've got to all the karma ever created by me and vow again. Vow again. And then go beyond vowing to develop a plan, to do something. While I was out of the country for 3 weeks, I read the biography of V.S. Naipaul. I don't know. There aren't any Indian people here today. Naipaul. Naipaul, I guess. V.S. Naipaul. From Trinidad. Considered the best Indian fiction writer of the 20th century. The thing about his biography that interested me in the first part of his biography was that he is, and this is an authorized biography, he's acknowledging all the hurts that he did to people in his authorized biography. He was not nice. He was not nice to his wife, and then his mistress, and he was not nice to her. He was not nice, and he's putting it out there. He's acknowledging it. And I was impressed. I thought, wow. I thought maybe this is unauthorized, but then I went back and it's authorized. But then, as I got into the second half of the book, I saw that his acknowledgement of karma, really, he's Indian. I don't know if he's Hindu or not, but he obviously grew up with a karmic idea. But his acknowledgement of karma was different than ours, because he says, these things were done by me. He doesn't say, I did these things. He doesn't say, all this karma ever created by me, I now fully acknowledge. He says, these things were done by me. It was inevitable. This is not the Buddhist idea of karma. This sense of karma, deeply rooted in India at the time of Buddha and still to the present day, not the Buddhist idea, though. Because if it's inevitable, well, then you just keep doing it, right? It's inevitable. It's inevitable that I'm going to keep blowing up at my wife, because that's just my disposition, to blow up at my wife. You know, like my dad blew up at his wife, so my grandfather's. Oh, come on. Come on. That's not Buddhist. That's not conduct that manifests the full moon. So Naipaul, he needed to work on his speech and his action. He actually, I think he had a yogic past, so he had probably, I don't know too much about this, but had a lot of experience with meditation. But meditation is just one of the legs. Without speech and action, what good is it? What good is it? So if he was working with a Zen teacher, the Zen teacher would say, mindfulness, that's one of the steps on the Eightfold Path. Use your mindfulness to pay attention to your speech, to pay attention to your action. Just use it. Just come back to. Okay, so Naipaul has a history of being verbally abusive to women. That's really obvious. And he's acknowledging it, although he's saying it's inevitable, which I don't know. but he's a, but if he's working with a Buddhist teacher, the Buddhist teacher says, looks at his books. I don't know if you've read his fiction. In his fiction, he is really able to be practice bare attention. He's able to look at he's psychologically so astute. He can look at someone. He can look at their body language. He can talk about the nuances about what they're feeling. He's a very sort of in the now kind of narrator in his fiction, but he obviously he doesn't do that with himself. So how do we help him? How do we help ourselves? Well, we pay attention. I pay attention to the impulse. Actually, I don't have impulses to blow up at my wife. I have other impulses, but but let's say I do. I pay attention to that. And then I see what's the feeling. I pay attention to the feeling. And what other feelings are there? Where are they in my body? And what are they coming from? What neediness? Is it 10-year-old Tim or 5-year-old Tim or 64-year-old Tim? And pay attention mindfully. And then don't act until we can act in a way that manifests the moon. And that doesn't mean waiting until you have some great enlightenment experience. That means till you're settled down and you're able to say something to someone that's not hurtful, that's honest and not hurtful. So Dogen, the Japanese teacher Dogen, says you should wait 3 days before you give someone, before you, if you're feeling hurt or you're feeling mad, you should wait 3 days. But the Japanese don't give you any sort of advice about how to deal with that. But Buddhism does itself. What I've just talked to you about in terms of mindfulness, that's cognitive behavioral therapy from Buddha, from India. Pay attention. Notice where it's coming up. Notice the different cognitions, and then wait until you can behave in a way that's counter to the original hurt. So that's what he's saying in the first two lines. He's saying, what is your plan, monks? What's your plan, monks? Not to get hooked by the last 15 days, the last 15 months, the last 15 years. What is your plan? The last 15 minutes. What's your plan to perform speech and action that others feel supported by? And what's your plan to increase and deepen your commitment to meditation? And meditation centers are set up to help you with this. For instance, we have our practice periods, two practice periods a year. And we have one starting in a month, and we had one in the fall. We do them only for 7 weeks. Historically, in Buddhist, since the time of the 10th century, they were done for 100 days, generally once a year. And in India, they were done 100 days in the rainy season. So practice period's a time that's set up for everybody to have a meditation commitment, for folks to get together once a week or twice a week, once a week, and talk about their meditation commitment. And the one we're going to be doing this time, starting in a month, is on silence and expression. Silence from our meditation and then expression. So we have these set up just like people have done it for 2,000 years, although a little differently because we all go home at night. Makes it a little harder for us. And then we go to work in the daytime. So I can't say we're doing it just like it's been done for 2,000 years. We're trying our best to integrate it into urban 21st century America. And in the monastic community, historically, there's a process of beginning this commitment formally, and then this commitment to both the conduct and the meditation, and then deepening the commitment and working some more, and then deepening it some more, and then emerging as what's called a Dharma heir. Some of you guys know that term very well. Some of you have never heard of it. It just means an independent teacher, but not teacher in the sense of someone who's going to teach you a bunch of stuff, but someone who's able to manifest that moon, who is able to help others, not by necessarily teaching, but more by just being. And the components of that historically are starting off with an initiation ceremony called Jukai in Japanese. Then there's an ordination ceremony for people who want to be ordained. Then there's something called a Shuso ceremony for people who've been working as ordinees for some time. And then finally what they call Dharma transmission. That's all the formal stuff. It's no guarantee that you'll... By majoring in creative writing in college, I got my bachelor's degree in creative writing. Then I got my master's degree in creative writing. Then I got a fellowship at so and so in creative writing. Versus someone like someone who didn't do any of that at all and didn't even go to college and becomes a great writer. You can't say. But we do have this formal process. We do have this formal process in Buddhism, in Zen, going back for, again, hundreds and hundreds of years. So I'm going to be actually helping some people through the first one, the initiation process, starting in April, and I do that every 2 years. And there's also a sense historically that when this is done, the teacher helps people, but also the community. The community helps. So the community sort of sanctions people to become leaders as they seem to be manifesting this meditation practice, this speech and action. And I don't think that my first teacher did this too well, Suzuki Roshi. He did it himself, meaning he didn't include the community. He just did it himself, and it didn't work too well. So I hope not. I hope I'm not. I hope to include everybody more. That's what I want to do. So anyway, I do not want to ask you about the last 15 days. Oh, boys and girls. Oh, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, arhats and bodhisattvas, I only want to ask you about the next 15 days. New Year, Happy New Year, full moon, right? The next 15 days. And nobody answers. And then every day is a good day, which maybe sounds a little Minnesota schmaltzy. But it's true that since the moon is always full, when the moon is at three quarters, it's full. When it's half, it's full. When you can't see it at all, it's full. How can there be anything but good days? It's the full moon. It's your Buddha nature. Duh. And Yunmen lived at a time of the five dynasties, the warring states. The dynasties were all warring with each other. This is after the golden age of Chinese Zen. It's gone. The golden age of Chinese Zen, all this wonderful stuff came out, and Before Zen got established, you know, before it was established. Golden Age is over, and it's the warring states. And so he's saying to his, and there are horrible things happening in China. And there are Buddhist armies fighting each other. You know, Buddhists have done that. I hate to say it. Hate to tell you that, but Buddhists have done that too. And they're still doing that, actually. They're still doing that. So here he is in the Five Dynasty era saying to his monks, every day is a good day. Every day is a good day. So when I was at my at the island that I have this little house on, I think my island. Well, it's mine. Everything is ours, you know. Well, let's not get too possessive about it. It's just ours because it's the full moon, right? So when I was at the island, at the house on the island, this guy who chattered on and on about the past was telling me, and I've been going to this island now for 5 years, how things have deteriorated on the island. He was talking about the good old days. He's been there for 10 years. I've been there for 5 years. 10 years, you know, there weren't automobiles. There weren't so many automobiles. Wasn't so much technology. People seemed to be treating each other better, and going on and on. And I was listening to him, you know, people out of, I was listening to him, doing my best to practice right speech and right action. And there was some suffering under what he was. What I was feeling was his suffering. And so I was actually wanting to be with him. But he talked about technology and about how technology was sort of taking over, and the kids were just on their video screens all the time, and how violent it was. And what I remember, and I've talked about this before, is I remember the Taoist teacher from the 3rd century before the contemporary era who says, oh, the invention of this water wheel has made totally corrupted our culture. In the good old days, we just got our water out of there. We just dipped our ladle into the water. We were close to the water in those good old days. So I've always been the good old days, haven't there? And Yunmen is saying the good old days are now. They're now. Which brings me to a story, which I have not read for 3 or 4 or 5 years. I had just one desire, to give myself completely to God, so I headed for the monastery. An old monk asked me, what is it you want? I said, I just want to give myself to God. I expected him to be gentle, fatherly, but he shouted at me, no! I was stunned. He shouted again, no! Then he reached for a club and came after me. I turned and ran. He kept coming after me, brandishing his club and shouting, no! No! That was years ago. He still follows me wherever I go. Always that stick. Always that now. Woo! I think these are the desert fathers. I think guys should stay at Zen Center. What'd you say? Pardon?
Now.
Now, N-O-W. Now, yeah. So, the good old days are now. They're now. Your full moon nature is here. Hakuin refers to us being children of a wealthy home, wandering away and getting lost among the poor. Wandering away, always wandering away. With our worrying, with our remembering, and also with our planning. And in Japanese monasteries, historically, and Katagiri Roshi and Suzuki Roshi were both like this, when anybody asks you anything in a monastic setting, immediately respond, "Hai," which means yes. "Hai." Doesn't matter what they ask you. You say, "Yes, yes, yes." And that's training. It was Japanese Zen training to bring us back to this, to this good moment, to be here, to be open in it. Some of you know the work of Milton Erickson, the famous psychotherapist, developed something he called the Yes Set. The Yes Set by Milton Erickson. Well, Milton Erickson dealt with a lot of people who would not only say every day is a good day, they'd say every day is a horseshit day. There's nothing good. There's nothing good. Everything is yucky. Everything is dark. Everything is confused. So Erickson's strategy was to get people to say yes about one thing. And he would start out on a morning like this morning, and he would notice someone coming into his office with a red nose and not very well dressed and rubbing their hands, and he'd say to himself, I mean, he did this quickly, he did this intuitively, "It's cold out there, isn't it?" And they'd say yes. That was the first yes. and then he would build on those yeses. He would build on those yeses till more and more. So man, the first yes is, "Yeah, it's cold out there." The second yes is, "I bet you really hate that." "Yes." "I bet you wonder why you're living in Minnesota." "Yes." But getting those yeses going, is bringing you here to this, and putting aside that all that stuff about the past. And then there might be a picture on the wall after he's gotten about four yeses or five yeses, and he sees that people are coming back a little bit just to being here with some positive energy. Then there'll be a picture on the wall of a warm day, and he'll say, "I wonder," or something like, "Don't you like the warmth in that picture?" And they say yes, and then the therapy from there just works. I mean, not exactly. The way Erickson does it, it always just works. But those of you who are really therapists know that it isn't quite as easy as that for either the therapist or the client. So Dogen says, "As the time right now is all there is, each being is, without exception, entire time." So the presence of the present. That's all we have. We don't have anything else. We've got nothing else. And I'm going to close with a Gary Snyder poem. The last three lines of Gary. The last, well, you could say two lines, three lines of Gary Snyder poem. "Consult my old advisors. Steady, they say, today. Consult my old advisors. Steady, they say, today." So that's Gary teaching us. One of the original people who brought the Dharma to us, and is still bringing it to us, Consult our old advisors, Our advisors are always present. The moon, full moon, is always present to advise us to be present, to advise us to acknowledge our karma, to vow, to change our activities, to commit ourselves to meditation, and to mindfully be present with all this. So I think that's what I want to say for today. And I will be glad to entertain questions or comments or stories or whatever. In Anybody?
What about the anxiety?
Pardon?
What about the anxiety that you might experience between the time you make your vow and then find out that you're not?
What about the anxiety that you experience between the time you make the vow and what?
And try to...
Yeah. The anxiety you experience between the time you make the vow and you try to really implement the vow, what about it? I mean, there it is. It comes up. It comes up. When it comes up, you may need to go back and make that vow again. You don't need to do it formally, because this is not necessarily about it. You mean, just remind yourself, I made the vow that I'm going to be there for you. I made that vow. But I'm anxious about it. You've been bugging me all day. And I'm anxious about whether I'm really going to do it. Because you're just on my nerves. So then I have to come back to I'm doing this because I care about you. Because I want to manifest the full moon, because I really believe there is a Buddha nature. There is that we are all one family. We are all emanate this. I come back to that original understanding and that original intention. Always we come back to the first two steps on the path. First one being understanding that we're all one family. And then the second one being our intention. And then my anxiety comes up. I have to come back again, maybe. Again and again and again, and then go through my anxiety and just act.
Could you be able to distinguish?
Pardon?
Could you distinguish between how, in the Christian tradition, you are supposed to feel guilty about sin? Because I'm trying to get away from that.
Well, I could try, but I'm not so good at that because I was raised Unitarian. So I think there are probably some other people who could help you on that. And not only that, I was raised California Unitarian, if you have any idea what that might be.
I'm just always a little bit concerned when I feel, I'm trying to get away from something. And I'm concerned when I feel myself kind of slipping back into something that's kind of, like the nuns.
Yeah, well, we don't have a concept of sin in Buddhism, but in some of the scriptures you see stuff that seems like sin, and I frankly, when I see it, I either ignore it or I interpret it differently, or I put the text away and don't teach it, because we talk about original ignorance, not original sin. Originally, we split ourselves off. We forget we're the full moon. I split myself off from you due to fear, because I'm afraid. And then I use greed to try to bring you in, or hatred to push you away, or I just wallow in delusion. So what I'm acknowledging is that I did this. Not that I was sinful, but that I ignored. That I ignored my lack of... original intimacy with you, that I'm already intimate with you, even if you're an animal, because we are it. We're it. So I'm acknowledging that. I'm apologizing. I'm crying a little, maybe, but there's no sin. I wasn't raised Christian, where's the sin? Pardon? Some of you guys could help him if you want to. But not me.
I don't know if I can help so much, but I was raised Muslim. I was raised Muslim.
You were raised Muslim, uh-huh.
We're kind of into the whole guilt thing.
You're into guilt? Yeah. I see.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
I had a problem as well, like, you know, just feeling, especially getting into the meditative state, I would often go back, and I don't know if I've gotten over it yet. I still think a lot in terms of penance, you know, in terms of I'm doing this because I did something bad, you know. But I guess the more
I... Could you speak a these people out there would like to hear you. Could you speak a little louder? Not to put you on the spot or anything.
I guess I still think a lot about penance, so I can't say I'm completely out of that yet, but the more I think about the things I've done, and not just my place in them, but all the factors, you know, everything that contributed to those bad things, you know, not just what I did, but everything that contributes to them, I feel like it's less sin and more, I don't know, I guess you put it pretty well when you said ignorance, you know, misfortune, and I end up regretting that more than I end up beating myself up for, you know, doing those things.
Uh-huh.
And I still regret them. Regret is not bad.
Thank you. Anybody else this morning?
Yes.
Yes. All right. Yes. Yes. Yes.
No.
He's doing a little Nagarjuna here. That's the next. That's the next talk.
So. the last 15 days completely fill the next 15 days. And this fullness is the moonlit glow of the snow you are dusting off your windshield.
Oh, thank you. One more time.
The last 15 days completely fill the next 15 days. And this fullness is the moonlit glow of the snow you are dusting off your windshield.
Thank you. Thank you all.